Headlines: Iran seizes two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf 2 days after the seizure of an Iranian oil cargo by Greece. People protest outside the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Houston, Texas, days after 19 students and two teachers were shot dead in a school. Also ahead, Cuba, Venezuela and Nicaragua condemn Washington's decision to exclude some Latin American countries from the upcoming Summit of the Americas. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has seized the two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf waters south of the country. In a statement, the IRGC said the vessels were seized for, quote, violations committed. According to shipping sources, Swiss Max's Delta Poseidon and Prudent Warrior had both loaded at Basra port in Iraq. The latter was carrying an oil cargo for the United States. The incident comes just days after Greece seized the oil cargo of an Iranian-flagged tanker and moved to deliver the crude to the United States. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has already summoned the Swiss and the Greek chargé d'affaires over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Political commentator Said Mohammed Mirandi believes by seizing the Greek-flagged tankers, Tehran is sending a message to Washington and its allies, warning them against harming Iran's oil trade.
Well, I think it's quite obvious. The Iranians are sending a message to NATO that if you touch our oil, you will pay the price, and the price of oil will go through the roof. The market is very tight. There is a shortage of oil, and the world economy is heading towards a major recession. So if the Americans and the Europeans want to make the situation much worse, then they could continue pushing the globe towards further tension. If they want to ease the oil market, then the only way forward is to respect international law, end their piracy, and to refrain from touching Iranian oil, Iranian assets, and which include Iranian tankers and super tankers.
Elsewhere, Israeli regime forces have killed a Palestinian teenager in an attack on Palestinian protesters in the south of the occupied West Bank. Medical sources said the regime troops shot dead the young Palestinian in the village of El Khadir. Meanwhile, regime troops also attacked protesters in several locations in Nablus province in northern West Bank, leaving at least 90 injured. They used rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Palestinians regularly hold anti-Israel protests after Friday prayers across the occupied West Bank. The demonstrators are angry at the continued Israeli aggression against the Palestinians and the regime's occupation of their land. Israeli forces have carried out several deadly raids in the territory in recent weeks, most notably killing Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqla in Jenin. A pro-Palestinian Church of England priest has faced a disciplinary tribunal in London over the past week for criticizing Israel and for what he calls Christian Zionist support for it. It comes after renewed complaints of anti-Semitism against Reverend Stephen Sizer by a Jewish group in Britain. Saeed Poreza reports on the final day of the proceedings.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, A belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer. But they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Now, anger is boiling in the United States over the recent fatal shooting at a Texas elementary school. Hundreds of protesters converge on the annual convention of the powerful gun lobbying group, the National Rifle Association, in Houston.
Not time to fix this problem, and they've only made it worse. What are we going to do?
The demonstrators held signs and chanted slogans demanding stricter gun control laws as the association's members gathered for the convention. The NRA has faced criticism for deciding to hold the gathering. Activists say it should have rather held a memorial ceremony for the victims of the school shooting. On Tuesday, an 18-year-old shooter massacred 19 children and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The incident has also raised criticism of the police, with officials acknowledging that officers were slow to take action.
Hey, from the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can.
The official added that the police received several emergency calls reporting that 8 or 9 children were still alive while the shooting was underway. Despite that, officers held back from making an entry for over half an hour. This has sparked fears that such instances of police inaction could cost lives during active shootings. The Cuban president has accused the U.S. of hegemonic practices after Washington handpicked Latin American states for the summit of the Americas.
The practice of exclusion is not new and confirms the United States' interest in controlling the inter-American system for hegemonic purposes and imposing its power to oversee democracy. This right does not correspond to them politically or morally. They claim to be promoters of democracy, which they deliberately confuse with their own system, but are unable to guarantee a plural space.
Miguel Diaz-Canel made the comments during a meeting of the 11-country Alba Bloc in Cuba. He had earlier announced that he would not attend the Summit of the Americas, which is scheduled for June. The U.S. has officially said it will not invite Venezuela and Nicaragua. Washington claims that the Venezuelan government is illegitimate and accuses the Nicaraguan president of authoritarianism. The U.S. has faced criticism for its decision, with several Latin American leaders threatening to boycott the events. Russia takes control of the railroad hub of Lyman as part of an assault aimed at capturing the last Ukrainian-held area in the eastern Donbass region. Pro-Russians say they have been in full control of Lyman. Ukrainian officials acknowledge that Russia captured most of the town. Ukraine's defense ministry says its forces are still blocking the Russians from launching an advance towards the nearby city of Sloviansk. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have encircled two-thirds of Severodonetsk, the biggest city held by Ukraine in the Donbass. Despite the Russian advances on the two major fronts in the Donbass, Ukraine says its forces still hold new defensive lines there. Russia's operation in Ukraine was launched in late February. While the Russian army continues its advances in the Donbass region of Ukraine, our correspondent Johnny Miller reports from a town near the front line recently taken by Russia.
This is the road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias.
We've stopped just outside the town near Ukrainian positions. There used to be Ukrainian positions, but they've now left. I've been told to take off my press identification on my vest here because if there are snipers, they may well target journalists.
The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
There will be people in this town who do not welcome the Russian soldiers here, who are more pro-Ukrainian, but either they have fled or they might be worried about saying that out loud. It's clear that the majority of people here anyway welcome the Russian soldiers.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base, the remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike.
Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive."
As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this, in the coming days and weeks, will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end. Svetlodarsk.
Two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Prodi has warned the sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot, mainly to Italy, Germany, and the European Union.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome. Known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation, Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump had sought to oust the Georgia governor, Brian Kemp, as part of his crusade to punish those involved in his 2020 defeat. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Lauren Gambino titled, "Wins for Kemp and Carr in Georgia Show Trump's Grip on GOP Slipping." Please stay with us to hear more about this story. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp won the state's Republican primary for governor on Tuesday, May 24th, easily overcoming a challenge from former Senator David Perdue in a resounding setback for Donald Trump. The Associated Press projected Kemp the winner over Perdue, revealing limits to the power Trump wields over the party he has remade in his image. The former U.S. president had sought to oust Kemp as part of a post-presidential crusade to punish the Republicans he blames for this 2020 defeat. Nursing a grievance after Kemp refused to overturn the results of the presidential election in Georgia, a contest that multiple reviews determined was won by Joe Biden, Trump courted to Perdue to mount a bid for governor. Perdue fully embraced Trump's myth of a stolen election, but recent polling showed him trailing far behind the incumbent governor, whose conservative agenda drew the support of many of the state's big donors and political leaders. Kemp will now face Democrat Stacey Abrams, setting the stage for a rematch of their showdown in 2018, when she narrowly lost the governorship, but emerged as a rising star on the left and a prominent advocate for voting rights. The race for governor of Georgia is expected to be one of the fiercely fought contests of the cycle. Once deeply Republican, Abrams is credited as the leading architect of parties expanding electoral power in Georgia, culminating in last year's election of two Democratic senators. Trump's misses in Georgia come as Republicans will still await the results of the nail-bittingly close Senate race in Pennsylvania, where Mehmet Oz, the celebrity heart surgeon who Trump endorsed, is running neck and neck with David McCormick, a hedge fund executive. Even in the races where Trump's preferred candidates lost, the election results so far this primary season are a testament to how entrenched Trump's big lie has become in Republican politics. Georgia's Republican Attorney General Chris Carr beat back a challenge from John Gordon, who made Trump's stolen election myth a central plank of his campaign. In a sign that not every race was going against Trump in the state, former football star Herschel Walker won the Republican nomination for Senate in what is already shaping up to be a marquee race that could determine control of the evenly divided chamber. Riding Trump's endorsement and his own celebrity in a state where football often seems to reign supreme, Walker managed to deflect questions about his academic and business achievements and a history of violence against his ex-wife. Walker, who is black, will face incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock, a longtime civil rights champion and the state's first black senator, who is running for a full term after winning the seat in a special election in 2021. In the northwest corner of the state, far-right Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene cruised to victory in a primary that tested conservative tolerance for her extremist brand of politics. A week after voters in North Carolina ousted her ideological ally, Congressman Madison Cawthorn. Trump's efforts to exact revenge on the Republicans who did not bend to his will in 2020 extends to a closely watched race for Secretary of State, in which the incumbent Brad Raffensperger faces a Trump ally. While much of the focus was on Republicans to Democratic incumbents, reflecting of the coalition that powered Biden's victory in the state, squared off in the newly redrawn 7th District. In the end, the Associated Press projected Congresswoman Lucy Macbeth prevailed in the race over a fellow House Democrat, Congresswoman Caroline Bordeaux, to win the party's nomination. Macbeth was recruited to run for office after her 17-year-old son, Jordan Davis, was shot and killed. Since his death, Macbeth has been an outspoken advocate for stricter gun laws. Macbeth's victory came just hours after a shooting occurred at an elementary school in Texas, leaving at least 18 children dead. Georgia is one of the several states holding primary elections on Tuesday, May 24th. In Arkansas, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, a former White House press secretary under Donald Trump, secured the Republican nomination in the race to become the state's new and next governor. Sanders is heavily favored to win the general election in November to replace the current Republican governor, Asa Hutchinson, who is term limited. If elected, Sanders will follow in the footsteps of her father, former Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, who led the state from 1996 to 2007. Meanwhile, in Texas, George P. Bush, the former president's nephew, failed to take down the embattled Attorney General Ken Paxton in a race that tested the strength of Bush family political dynasty. Paxton, who was endorsed by Trump after leading an unsuccessful lawsuit that asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the 2020 election, despite no evidence of widespread fraud, is the subject of an ongoing FBI investigation related to charges of corruptions and separately was indicted in 2015 for securities fraud.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and condolences to you on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here are some points to ponder, as taught to us by the 60 Imam. Islam could be called naked, thus prudency is its dress, decorum is its adornment, good deed is its personality, and piety is its pillar. Everything should have a basis. The basis of Islam is the adoration to us, the Prophet's progeny.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام أول ما يبر الرجل ولده أن يسميه باسم حسن فليحسن أحدكم اسم ولده.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, the very first act of kindness of a man towards his son is to give him a good name. So keep good names for your children.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful dialogues of the divinely appointed imams, of course, we find many dialogues with family members, with friends, with companions, and with the people in general. But what is really interesting is that there is a certain conversation found in the traditions by the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. But what is interesting is that in this conversation and in this dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, puts forth some pieces of advice to his son. What a beautiful conversation between a father and a son. And so in this dialogue between Imam al-Kadhim and his son, Imam al-Kadhim says, O my little son, beware that Allah misses you during an act of obedience that He has commanded you to perform. Dear friends, there are many times where we are supposed to be committing an act of obedience, and yet for some reason we do not commit that act of obedience. For example, there is something that is wajib that we must do. It is obligatory that we do a certain action, but for some reason we end up not doing that wajib, that obligatory action. And so here, Imam al-Kadhim, as he advises his son in this beautiful dialogue between father and son, he says, be very careful that Allah does not see you committing an act that you are supposed to be doing. Now, sometimes we think that committing an act or doing an act which is wajib is limited to the salah or the fasting. you know, or Hajj or Zakat or Khums or these things. There are other times, brothers and sisters, where something must be said. For example, supporting an oppressed person, helping somebody who is under oppression, helping somebody who is being bullied, and yet we stay silent when we should have said something. This too is an act of obedience, which we did not do, and Allah witnessed that we did not do. And on the other hand, excuse me, there are times where we should be silent, but yet we tend to speak out, perhaps because of emotion or anger or jealousy or greed. Again, something that we should have done. We should have had obedience to Allah, and yet we did not. So beware, and be careful, and be wary, for Allah sees both our acts of disobedience, things that we should not do, as Allah sees our acts of obedience, things that we should all do. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt was to change that. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt is to change that. To become the rule of God, no one has the right to govern people in a way that is in the ruler's best interest. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's laws are put in place. God has given us these laws. In ahsantum, ahsantum li anfusikum wa in asa'tum falaha. Those laws are given for our own benefit. If we abide by these laws, we will benefit from it. If we don't, we will be hurt. And this is about any individual that implements those laws. And on a societal level, on a global level, for all people, if people implement those laws, if governments implement divine laws and govern people's lives based on God's instructions, people will benefit. No one has the right to come forth and establish laws that are in the interest of a few, and the masses don't benefit from that materially as well as spiritually. The rule of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the rule of Islam, the rule of the Ahlul Bayt, the rule of the representatives of the Ahlul Bayt means that.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, Pardesic News. With the light.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinoz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinoz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinoz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400 square meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? What's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Iran has made it clear that the security of the region is the collective responsibility of the littoral states, and therefore the presence of any foreign forces in the Persian Gulf, especially of the U.S., is highly detrimental to regional stability. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Iran's Firm Resolve for Regional Stability. Stay tuned for more. Iran and Oman have been neighbors since time immemorial. Unlike the other states on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf, including the largest one, Saudi Arabia, all of which are colonial creations. This is not to discredit them, since these former British protectorates and presently American client states are, after all, neighbors to the Islamic Republic and Muslim by tradition, even if some of them, or more properly, the tribal clans that lead them, have blundered in inviting the rapacious Zionist wolf to their region. Anyway, the usurper regime of Israel is not expected to last long in Palestine, let alone its undesirable diplomatic presence in the Persian Gulf, while Iranians and the Arabs, as inseparable parts of the great Islamic Ummah, will continue to live as neighbors and share the rich resources of the region, irrespective of the undesirable presence of the Americans, who, like all outside intruders, will soon become part of history. Iranians and the Arabs, as well as all other Muslims, whatever their ethnicity or language, Turkic, subcontinental, African, European, and Southeast Asian, need to cooperate with each other and coordinate views for reviving glories of the great Islamic civilization. This has been the principal policy of Iran ever since the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And in spite of the wars, economic sanctions, and terrorism imposed by the U.S. to try to create bad blood between Muslims, Tehran has spared no efforts to promote Islamic solidarity by fostering good neighborly relations with all. This is evident by the recent visit to Muscat of the Iranian president, who earlier this month had played host to the Emir of Qatar within 3 months after his official trip to Doha. Earlier, President Dr. Sayed Ibrahim Raisi, who was elected head of the executive branch of the government less than a year ago, had paid a state visit to Russia in January, preceded by official trips to the Central Asian countries of Tajikistan in September and Turkmenistan in November. Among the heads of state so far received in Tehran by President Raisi, mention could be made of President Barham Saleh of Iraq, President Ilham Aliyev of the Republic of Azerbaijan, and President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, as well as Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan of Armenia. Important accords were made during the Iranian president's meetings with senior leaders of these countries, and last Sunday in Muscat, Dr. Raisi and Sultan Haytham bin Tariq Al Said signed at least 12 agreements in various fields. This is indicative of the firm resolve of the Islamic Republic of Iran to promote brotherly relations to the benefit of both the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Sultanate of Oman, which are located on the opposite sides of the Strait of Hormuz at its narrowest point of entry to the Persian Gulf. Iran has made it clear that the security of the region is the collective responsibility of the littoral states, and therefore the presence of any foreign forces in the Persian Gulf, especially of the U.S., is highly detrimental to regional stability. We hope the truth will dawn on those countries of the region who seem to be in deep slumber and ignorant of the designs